Hi, everybody. I'm Brittany Lewis with Forbes Breaking News. Joining me now is Isabella Ramirez, President and Editor-in-Chief of the Columbia Daily Spectator. Isabella, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, hello. Nice to be here.
As you know very well, you're a Columbia junior. Columbia University has garnered national attention over their on-campus protests and protests right off the campus. Can you tell us, from your perspective, being on campus, what are you seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. The past few days have, of course, been an incredibly emotional time for the Columbia community. What truly has transpired is, of course, really beginning with the congressional hearing of Shafeeq before Congress, where, you know, that same morning that, you know, Shafeeq was slated to show up in D.C. And actually myself and part members of my team were there in D.C., student protesters had organized to set up an encampment at literally 4 a.m, so in the middle of the night slash the morning. And I think what really has spurred out of that, right, out of the sort of clashing and intermix and interplay of these very public things that are happening on our campus, which all eyes were on Shafeeq in D.C., but then those eyes were very quickly diverted to what was happening right here in New York City, right here on her campus while she was away. And then, of course, as she came back, I think, you know, this has been really the culmination of, since October 7th, a lot of tension on campus, of course, a lot of protests, a lot of back and forth between the university, the students, the faculty, and then also among those groups, right? Students who disagree with each other, faculty, etc. But I think what we've truly seen in this phenomenon right now is a pent-up frustration from many, many groups, right? It didn't necessarily, there are some senses in which this came out of nowhere, or at least it was a surprise and it was intended to be so, right? Such a large showing of protests, but in some senses it's not a surprise. And so how I kind of look at those two things is actually very much before the start of the encampment, there was actually a drop in protest activity. It was still active, but not as much as we saw in the very beginning stages of university, of what our campus really looked like. And part of that had to do with the crackdown on disciplinary action and policies that the university was taking on some of these protests. But this has been kind of like a resurgence, especially for sort of the pro-Palestinian students on our campus, in terms of coming together and organizing this very massive, massive showing, which has then kind of inspired and invited these outside protests to come outside of our gates and sort of join in this really big, now global, arguably, movement across universities in solidarity sort of with what's happening on campus. But of course, at the same time, there are these underlying tensions that were crucial to the point of the hearing, right? What is Columbia doing to address anti-Semitism? How is Columbia juggling this act of how do we preserve free speech on our campus and free expression, along with the academic expression of faculty, which is a very big topic in the congressional hearing, along with the safety concerns that are arising out of Jewish students and faculty who are on our campus, who are navigating this space in sometimes very different ways, but for some of them are, you know, afraid of certain sides of this campus, or afraid of navigating outdoor protests, and have felt a sense of urgency from the university, or wanted to compel the university to feel more urgent about this issue. And so really what this is a culmination of is months and months of building and building tensions. Obviously, this political power that had entered this arena for Columbia, right? Putting Columbia on the map, like very purposely singling us out as they did with Harvard, Penn, and MIT, of course, brought this all sort of into one really big mix that it became, or it has become, not just about the one experiences of, you know, this university in New York City, this Ivy League institution, but also a microcosm of what is happening at American universities across the nation, but also what is happening at large in terms of our political conversations regarding anti-Semitism, free speech, the right to protest, and all of these sort of intermixing things. So I really do see this as it has been building over time. And in a lot of senses, we could have seen where it was building to. Of course, maybe we couldn't have anticipated the sheer scale, but it was clear that there was going to be some flashpoint and that it was coming our way. And I think the congressional hearing certainly propelled that way faster, maybe on a timeline that was very quick, but also just the nature of the fact that the semester is ending. So this is the last time to really, you know, for students to try to confront these issues. And as we've seen, they're doing it in an incredibly public and expansive manner.
So it sounds like from what you're saying, and your team has done a great job of reporting, things really reached a boiling point last week, and they continue to just be, and it continues that way throughout this week. And I am curious, your team has been on the ground inside Columbia's campus, talking to the protesters inside the encampment. What do they want, A, and B, what is the difference between the protest inside the campus and the one right outside of the gates?
Yeah, so super great questions. I think for the first one, their demands have been very explicit. From the moment we reported it, we broke the story at 5 a.m, it was clear that they told us, and that their message is, we are not leaving, at least not voluntarily, until our demand, very specifically for divestment from Columbia of, you know, from companies with potential ties to Israel, until Columbia makes that decision and also provides us with the financial transparency to be able to evaluate their success in that, right? And so a lot of this has boiled down to very explicit financial and tangible, sort of what they've identified to be tangible ties between the university and Israel. And that also expands kind of beyond divestment as well, as the university does have programs hosted in Tel Aviv, a new global center that was actually announced, you know, I believe a year ago, and was very controversial at the time of its announcement. And so it's even more so at the time that we're in now. And so what people have identified are these very explicit, or what they define to be these very explicit ties between the university and Israel. And what they're demanding is a severance of those ties. And I think, but what is central is truly the financial aspect, the BDS, right? The boycott, divestment and sanctions list, divesting from companies that are listed on that list, and also any other sort of possible ties to weapons manufacturers, military applications. And so that has really been the central demand. And like I said, they have committed to not leaving until those demands are met. And so there are ongoing negotiations actually at this time between the administration and these student organizers. Shafiq actually alluded to it in a recent statement that was on Monday about, you know, these not an insight into what these negotiations might look like moving forward, although we still don't have a quite big idea as to like what is the reconciliation point here, or where do we come to with this? But we know that there is active conversation between those parties, but also that conversation is, I'm sure, very tense. And so to your second question, which is the difference between these off-campus and on-campus groups or protests, I think that has been like an incredibly important distinction that we have really tried very hard to make at Spectator. Not only because of the importance that holds for our community, but also the transparency and for the truth and the fact telling. It is very clear to make the difference between what is an affiliate-led protest led by the student organizers here who have been leading protests for the past several months versus the protests that are coming from outside, from other organizations that are in solidarity with these students, but are not necessarily affiliated at all with the university. And so, also, the aspect of sort of control looks different. Like, in fact, the encampment has a set of community guidelines that it follows. It sort of, you actually can walk in and there's this like kind of banner that has a list of everything that the encampment follows by. And they've also been publicizing that online. But you can see that there is actually kind of an interesting community being formed like via this encampment. It's not taking the form of a typical protest. Of course, there's protest activity, and they are protesters. Like, that is an accurate, I think, description. But at the same time, the people involved, it looks so different day to day. We're seeing, like, pre-scheduled programming occurring in this encampment, from teach-ins to movie screenings to yesterday for the commencement of Passover, a Seder that was held inside the encampment specifically for Jewish students. And so there are these incredibly interesting dynamics that are occurring and that are taking place inside this encampment. But once the moment you step out of that, those community guidelines, right, these like set of sort of rules that they're promising to abide by as like a miniature community, are kind of they're not at all applicable to sort of what's happening outside. And so I think a lot of the incidents that people have pointed to, right, of incidents of pretty blatant anti-Semitism, specifically some that have been publicized recently about students being told, you know, pretty violent rhetoric, being told to go back to Poland, these terminologies, evocations of the Holocaust, right, these incredibly anti-Semitic tropes, a lot of which have been happening outside the gates in a place that there's a lack of necessarily control, both on behalf of the students, but also on behalf of the administration, right? As soon as you step outside that campus gate, you are in now NYPD territory. You're no longer in sort of campus and policy territory. So that's where it gets really, really wishy-washy, right? So what do you do when you have students, Jewish students, who are being targeted, are being told things off campus, where it's the jurisdiction of the university to protect those students, but it's not the jurisdiction to discipline those who are unaffiliated with the university for those actions? And there have been quite several arrests and other things, not often related to these anti-Semitic incidents at all, related to sort of just protest activity. But I think that's a really big pain point right now. It's like, how do we navigate these off-campus protests that are, you know, inevitably have been brought by the encampment or have been brought as an inspiration of the encampment, but are ultimately very different things. And that's also not to necessarily diminish the idea that there have been incidents that have also happened on campus. It is just more so crucial to make differentiation as to when and where they're happening, who they're affecting, who is being involved, and really trying as best as possible as reporters, as media, to identify the very explicit actors involved in this, who is responsible, who is accountable, and who is affected, and why does it matter? And whether it happens off campus or on campus, it absolutely matters. It does matter that these students are being impacted in this way. But the question remains of, you know, there is a limitation sometimes to what the administration can do and not do. And it's a really weird dynamic too, because people feel within the campus that the university has overexerted, and outside the campus has underexerted. So it's sort of like, where is the middle ground there?
Can you quantify just how many students are involved in this encampment, involved in the demonstrations? And overall, what is the temperament on the campus? Because you're having Jewish students say, hey, I don't feel safe at this university that I pay for, that I call my school.
Right. I mean, I definitely think in terms of climate, people have such different temperature checks on what that looks like. I think that if you were to ask many of the pro-Palestinian protesters that we speak to, what they would describe is something very peaceful, very community-oriented, very much focused on, yes, it is a very visible and public demand against the university, but I think that's what they see it as, right? I think that they very explicitly see it as a student versus administration issue, right? That there is a tension with the administration that they're attempting to amend. And of course, other external people are involved in that, students, faculty, et cetera. But I think that's sort of where the focus for them lies. And then there are other students on campus who have been expressing to us that just the sheer nature of navigating campus, seeing the encampment, seeing the activity outside, is incredibly distressing to them. And so it's so interesting to see such opposing accounts of what is happening. And I think even in our reporting, you know, it's really hard to try to capture like some sort of quote middle ground, because I don't necessarily think that that quite exists. Like, I don't think that that person, one person's characterization is wholly wrong and the other person's characterization is wholly right. I think there's a kind of a little bit of everything, right? I think that there is, at the same time that there could be a potential for this encampment to represent for a lot of people a community space, a sort of reclamation of power in some instances, right? This idea that the university has had power over us for a long time, and now we have the most significant disruption that has happened on our campus since October 7th that is impeding the university from doing its functions, from setting up for graduation, for commencement, from doing a lot of the things that it's intending to do. Our classes have shifted online. It is clearly a very significant disruption of all activity on our campus. And so I think that is obviously intentional, but I think a lot of where that viewpoint there is that could both be true, and that there's also a community being formed at this encampment, and then it can also be true that there are characterizations from other students that they aren't not feeling safe. And we've heard it from also not just Jewish students and Israeli students, but also from the leaders at this campus, right? From the head of Hillel, the head of Shabbat, the head of many different organizations here that are dedicated to Jewish student life are saying the same thing. And I think, but ultimately, an interesting unifying thread in all of this is, okay, if this is all true, where are they pointing to? And it does seem that the bottom line is still when the Jewish student leaders or Jewish leaders on our campus, the rabbis, the other executives are saying, hey, this campus is not safe for students, they're often pointing to administration directly.
Isabella, you're in a really interesting position right now, because not only are you a student at Columbia, you are the editor-in-chief of the main media covering this story around the clock. So when you look at national media compared to what you're covering, what you're seeing, what your reporters are gathering, what do you think, where do you think the media is getting it wrong?
Right. You know, I've been asked this question quite a bit, and I think overall, what I truly see is that, look, for us as student journalists, we occupy such an interesting position for ourselves where we live and eat and sleep in the same community that we report on. And that's an incredibly unique feat, and that's a feat of student journalism, but it's also local journalism, right? That's what we've adopted to be in our kind of small community. And so what I think is we have a certain historical and contextual understanding of what has been happening on our campus that is very different. When I report on the people that I report on, whether it is in a, you know, we're reporting on incidences that are incredibly emotional, intense, and hard to write about and report on, or it's about the community performances that were put on at the encampment, we are reporting on our peers, ultimately, right? These are people that we actively engage with in dialogue beyond spectator, that we're constantly in communication with. And, you know, I always caution against sort of, it's sometimes I see my own sort of campus represented in media, and it's really hard because I see it, and I see it so closely as a student journalist. I often know what is wrong here. I truly know this place pretty inside and out, and so do many of our journalists here. At the same time, you know, as a student here, I know the people that are here. I know the scholars that I look up to and the professors who have been crucial in my shaping as a journalist, as a just a student, the friends that I have here, the peers that I have. I know the community at large. And you know what's also really important? I know a Columbia before this. And I think that is so critical to this understanding, is I don't think Columbia can change like that overnight. Like, I think that we are been placed in the limelight, obviously, but just in the center of something so tense for the entire world, right? You know, how can you expect 18, 19, 20, 21 year olds to be trying to understand what is happening in such a time where not even our politicians and our national outlets understand what is happening to the fullest degree? Like, we are very much processing as we're learning, as we're reporting, as it's unfolding. And so I think it's a very different angle to be an outside outlet kind of parachuting in to some extent sometimes to try to understand what's happening at this exact moment in time. And I also think not only with that, but as a spectator, as a campus organization, we are here no matter whether Columbia's in national news or not. And that is also really critical. We are a pillar and here for accountability and all the things that we stand for, whether or not we're in the national media or we are just reporting on sort of the day-to-day and the sort of normalcy that, you know, the normal student life experience or the faculty experience. And I think that is what makes our coverage obviously so much more in depth, right? We're not picking up the biggest thing that's coming out of Columbia that day. We're picking up every single thing that's coming out of Columbia that day, from the small decisions that were made at, you know, from Shafiq or the encampment or from other parties surrounding, from statements that are being made from student organizations. Of course, you know, we might pick up almost every statement or at least as many significant statements as we can, but maybe other outlets, and reasonably so, I understand that position. I'm someone who also, you know, enjoys like media and plans to work in media. So I think that it's not even necessarily a critique of the industry at large necessarily, but rather how, you know, just there's so many factors to this, but I think just our ability to be able to report on every single development, whether or not it is the biggest development of that day, is really important to our community and also shows that, again, we are there no matter what. As spectator, we have always been there. We've been here since for literally over a century, right? Since 1877, the Spectator has existed. And so we have a really long legacy here of preserving the history of our student body. And we are committed to doing so in such a localized level. And I think that's what really elevates our coverage and really what I wish more so what national media could engage with is what was a Columbia before this and what is a Columbia during and what is a Columbia potentially after this?
That's what I want to ask you, because the finals are in the beginning of May. Graduation is in a few weeks. You mentioned you know what a Columbia before this looked like. What does a Columbia after this look like? And what is the solution to get to the after of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's so challenging to try to come up with a solution as things develop so quickly. But I think what does a Columbia look after this is there must be a way in which we need to repair the immense fractures on our campus. The divide here is very, very deep. And that's something that's been identified by students, but also by faculty, by administrators themselves. Shafiq, in her own statement, she says that she's deeply saddened. She says that she is really, really trying to grapple with what a divisive community looks like. And so, you know, this is in a lot of regards an unprecedented time, absolutely. In some other regards, there is a strange precedent for moments like this, and specifically a very big moment in time for Columbia, cited very heavily and seen in parallel to this moment is 1968, in which there were a lot of anti-war protests at Columbia for against the Vietnam War, and also kind of looped into that was a protest against a gym that was going to be constructed in Morningside Park that had separate entrances for residents and affiliates. It was sort of labeled Jim Crow, a de facto, like what they described as a de facto segregation. So there was, and it was humongous turmoil. And that was one of the only other times in which the university authorized the NYPD to come in and sweep campus or to clear, in this case, occupied buildings on our campus. And so, yes, this moment is pretty unprecedented. At the same time, when we reflect on 1968 as a larger university community, we see it as a pain point for our university. We do see it as a stain in our legacy in terms of, I've spoken to, when I did my exit interview with the former president, Lee Bollinger, he sees it as a very big mark on this university that we've been ever since repairing. And that is a really big thing in this, which is to say is we have learned a lot from that moment and from other moments like it. And I think right now we're in it in terms of we're in this present and we're so deeply in the present and we're so deeply in the day-to-day. But there has to be a moment to be able to step back and be like, what did we learn from the other times that this has similar things have occurred, right? I can't draw perfect parallels, but the closest thing that I can imagine, again, with the police presence, with the sort of amount of protest is that moment. And after that moment, there were changes. We established what is called the University Senate. We established these governing bodies and these policies as a checks and balances on the university president, on the administration, to say, hey, the student body needs to have some sort of say in all of this. And so right now we're actually following a development regarding that right now. What potentially the university senate's role and maybe governing bodies outside of, you know, just the top administration. And when I refer to governing bodies, I mean the university's senate is comprised of students, faculty, and administrators, so kind of like a diverse array, and these are people who are voted in to represent, like, as senators. And so there are conversations about what is the role of, again, something that was established in the aftermath of an incredibly divisive time on our campus that led to the mass arrests of protesters, that led to very, very large scale protests. And we established this thing as a checks and balances. So we need to come back and reevaluate what is the appropriate process moving forward for these so-called checks and balances, right? I think there's been a frustration of, like, well, of course, to some extent, the university can kind of act in the way that it wants to, right? Like, that is the power of the president, and it is an important power in a lot of senses. But when people feel that that has been overstepped, of course, via the NYPD, that is very concerning. And then also now that these students are kind of on the lawns and with the encampment, there's also a question of, you know, what's their power in all of this? Because I do feel that they have built power in terms of to be able to disrupt to such an extent, again, very intentionally, is the building of power and the building of, for the first time maybe, the students have kind of a wedge against the university, where the university is trying to figure out how are they going to proceed, and it's not as simple maybe as they imagined, as, okay, we're going to invoke the highest of our powers and have the universe or have the police department come sweep this encampment, because clearly that wasn't enough of an incentive to kick students or to propel students to, like, leave and disrupt or stop this protest. So I think the question moving forward is, what are the checks and balances that are necessary for this situation? Who's going to need to have the power moving forward? Because clearly we're seeing a dynamic shift of the university is in power in a lot of senses, but the students are building power against them in a lot of ways. And that's not just the pro-Palestinian protesters, but there has been a lot of, even with Jewish and Israeli students who have brought up concerns with this, there's clearly building, right? I mean, the congressional hearing is the best example of that power building, right? It's going beyond. So we need to evaluate now who needs to be part of this conversation moving forward in terms of what is the decision to be made, because evidently the university, although it is assumed that it should be operating on its own, or in terms of, like, the administration, yes, again, does have the sole power to do this, but it seems that they've hit a bar in terms of, like, they've invoked one of the highest powers that they could possibly invoke against students, and it still hasn't done the results that they need. So what's the step here? Is it continuously invoke that power? Are we going to see another sweep? Are we going to see some fringe sort of outspoken individuals have even implied that we should call in the National Guard? That would, of course, be, I think, a really, really deeply traumatic thing for our university and also for the public eye and for the image. There's so many implications in that, but I'm bringing that up as a fringe idea that does exist. At the same time, we know that the backlash with that and also the effectiveness, frankly, of that is kind of in question right now. Is like, at what point does the university expend way too much trying to just repeatedly do what it has done before? Invoke the same powers that it has tried to invoke, suspending students, the NYPD, doing all of these, like, kind of disciplinary, like, realms, taking sort of some advice from Congress in the sense of, like, you need to be cracking down on this, you need to be, disciplining the students who are violating your policies, and you need to be explicit about those policies when it comes to anti-Semitism. The university has done that, or it is doing that, and Congress is arguing that they can be doing more. But on the student end, the argument is sort of, where do we go from here if it seems like the students, I truly believe, are very adamant on their demands, and I really don't think it's going so strong in the sense that they're continuing, and I'm actually quite impressed by the level of, for example, like remembering that students are literally sleeping on the lawns, are eating on the lawns, are sharing, are kind of going away with their very comfortable dorm room, their kind of their resources to purposely make a stand. The question from here is, who needs to be involved in that decision, and how do we make it representative enough of the university, right? With consideration that these students can't possibly, although very large in mass, can't possibly represent every single person here. So what's the best way for us to try to do that? Obviously, we can't function in a perfectly democratic way, but if the university has reached a point in which it doesn't seem like there's that much they can do further in terms of, like, yes, they can continue suspending students, they could sweep the encampment again, they could do all of this. But what do you do with the movement that stays, right? With the, I would argue, you do that again, the solidarity protests outside become 10 times more intense. The backlash, the outcry from students within become also 10 times more intense. I believe that it could make the campus further unsafe, even with the intention of making it safer by invoking the NYPD, right? These are all conversations that are clearly brewing, and by the fact that, you know, only a few days have passed, but still from Thursday to now, there has been a sort of an interesting lack or we're trying to understand what the university is quite thinking, because obviously they haven't touched the encampment very much, besides they were like, oh, you know, at first they were saying to not put up tents, now the tents are back up. So we're sort of just watching, right? And interestingly enough, we're spectating.
A word that we keep using in this conversation is flashpoint. The encampment at Columbia spurred national encampments at other universities. Yeah. Yesterday, we saw faculty walk out in solidarity with the protesters. Is there any indication of when these conversations towards a resolution will occur?
Right. So as I mentioned, there are ongoing negotiations between the organizers and administration, although the insight into that is going to be very limited. We're continuing our reporting on that, absolutely. I think, like I said, there has been movement from some of the governing bodies, right? So the student councils have been kind of in on this, like, sort of surrounding issue for a long time in terms of, like, at least in the periphery, but now they're becoming more and more involved. Just yesterday, the Columbia College Student Council, which represents, of course, the Columbia College undergraduate population, voted, or they proposed a referendum on their ballot, and it was passed with majority. So I believe it were somewhere between 60 to 70% voted in favor of divestment from the university. And also there were a few other percentages regarding the severance of the program between Tel Aviv University and Columbia, Tel Aviv, the Global Center, and Columbia. So, but of course that was still, you know, a 40% of the student body voted, and of those 40, 60 to 70% voted in favor, right? We're still talking in numbers that are, but that are building, right? SGA, which is the Barnard version of the councils, is also has the same kind of referendum, and a few other councils are contending with the same ballot issue. And, you know, we sort of acknowledged from the beginning that the vote on the ballot doesn't necessarily maybe do anything in terms of tangibly do something, but it shows something is what they're attempting to show. They're attempting to show some sort of attempt at a consensus, or some sort of attempt at something of, like, clearly enough people on this campus believe in a certain way, or that the university should be acting differently. And sort of, I think that's where that is coming in. But there is more movement from, I think, faculty organizers as well, as you pointed out with the walkouts. They have been organizing in the background for a very long time. A lot of what's happening is behind closed doors, and that's why our reporting is super crucial to try to bring that to light and see what is the insight into all of this. But I truly believe that that the way forward is going to continuously really have to figure out, who do we need to bring in on this conversation? What's the weight and the level of like I said, what is the weight we need to give each person's sort of viewpoint and response and thoughts about the university? Because so many people are going to think so many different things, and we can't possibly do all of them at the same time. So we need to come to a way of, as a community, of coming together and imagining what do we need to move forward and who do we need to engage. And I think that's the most critical question that it seems that Shafiq is trying to ask, and it seems that her administrators around her are trying to ask, is who needs to be involved in this, whether or not, you know, I think they got to a point where they were able to choose not to engage maybe some of those parties, right, those faculty, those students, but now they're actually being forced to, right, like I said, with the ongoing negotiations with student organizers. So that is what's going to be super critical here, is how is that engagement actually going to tangibly influence what decisions they make moving forward.
Isabella Ramirez, thank you so much for your reporting. As this situation develops, I hope you come back on and join me again. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you so much. Lovely to have this conversation with you.